I have a couple of announcements before we get started. First announcement, LCUUC will host Homeless Families for Family Promise again on November 29th. So please sign up for a shift on the sign up in the social hall or online. You can see Sheila, Robert, Gina, or Bill if you have any questions. Also, this is the last Sunday before the potluck, so it's the last Sunday to sign up for the potluck because it's next Sunday. If you need to sign up, see Barb Adams. And then two other last announcements. Kids K through 8 will go to the social hall for rehearsal for the Christmas pageant after the service. So when they leave with the lantern, they will go to the social hall for practice and then to their classes. And one last word, soup.
Good morning. I'd like to thank Nancy and Isabel for playing some Bach for us today. Bach is thinking in music with the different lines that weave in and out. Conversation, and that's what thinking is us talking to ourselves. And so that's what Bach does too with music. I also asked Paul to say a few words when we do the lighting of the candles for the joys and concerns for the tragedy that happened in Paris. And so we want to keep those people in our minds during the service today, their loved ones, especially that were left behind, and those who were injured so that they might heal fast. We come into this sacred place to seek transcendence. We come here today to open ourselves to the possibility of revelation, to the epiphany of goodness in the holy face of the other person. The other person challenges my sameness, my comfortable knowledge of things. The other person disturbs my sleep, my dogmatic slumber. But the other is also my open door to a world that is not mine alone, the invitation to the wonder and vitality of the strange world that is nowhere and everywhere comes from the voice of the other. Please take a moment to say hello or to introduce yourself to the others around you this morning.
you. Please rise in body or spirit and join me in our opening hymn, number 27, I Am That Great and Fiery Force. Welcome to Lake Country Unitarian Universalist Church. At LCUUC, we strive to surround this community in the spirit of love in everything we do. My name is Paul Fackler, and I'm the worship associate for this morning's service. No matter who you are or where you have come from, you are welcome here. Whether you lack the swift erudition for New York or suffer from lapsed pulchritude and thus can't hang out in L.A., you're welcome here. Whether you are too big for your britches or too humble to tell, you are welcome here. Whether you are a member of the know-nothing party or just a know-it-all, you are welcome here. You are welcome if you know what you are doing or if you haven't a clue. You are welcome if you couldn't think your way out of a paper bag or if you know the mind of God. Whether you are an empiricist, an idealist, a realist, a theist, an atheist, a deist, a cretin, a bozo, a boozer, a Buddhist, a Hindu, a Nietzschean, a Heideggerian, a human, or just a regular Joe or Joanne, you are welcome here. You are also welcome if you are none of the above. We welcome those who have known nothing but acceptance in their lives and those who have known the pain of exclusion and suffered disdain for their differences. LCUUC is a UUA-recognized welcoming congregation, which means we welcome and affirm queer and trans people, and all people, regardless of who they love or what pronouns they use. Please join us for refreshments and conversation in the social hall after the service, and while you're there, stop by the welcome table to find out more about LCUUC. For those born prior to the computer age, today's order of service includes announcements of upcoming church activities, and we look forward to everyone joining in. For those born in the computer age, like and follow LCUUC on Facebook in order to get ongoing information about activities. And check out our webpage at LCUUC. It's far more difficult than I make it out to be. LCUUC.org. To stay current on all events. Please take a moment at this point in the service to place a dome of silence over any electronics you may have here with you today. And thanks for being here. We are so pleased you have chosen to celebrate and worship with us. One of the ways that we care for our wider community is by contributing to our local food pantries, both financially and through the collection of non-perishable food items, which we donate each month. If you have food items to share, please bring them forward at this point in the service, or ask a child to bring them forward for you, and I invite the children of any age to come to the front and enjoy a story. Good morning. Okay, we'll let everybody get settled in. Today's story is called I Wonder by Anicus Harris, and it's illustrated by John Rowe. So have any of you read this story before? Do you wonder what it's about? Oh, sure. Thank you. So, I Wonder by Annika Harris. Yes. Ava loves to look for the moon. It follows her from place to place, disappearing behind trees and mountains, and then appearing again someplace new. Look, Mama, there it is. The moon looks so beautiful in the sky. How do you think it follows us, Ava? Ava thinks about it, but she can't figure it out. It's okay to say I don't know, says her mother. When we don't know something, we get to wonder about it. I wonder if the moon and earth are friends, says Ava. Her mother smiles. I like that idea. Are the moon and earth friends? I wonder. Next page. But Mama, how does the moon really stay close to us? There is an invisible force called gravity that pulls all the things in the universe together, Ava's mother explains. Gravity keeps the moon close to the earth, and it keeps the planets close to the sun, too. They circle around, like this. Ava understands a little better, but then she starts to wonder, Mama, where does gravity come from? Next page. I don't know, Ava. Nobody really knows for sure. And when no one knows the answers to something, it's called a mystery. A mystery is something for everyone to wonder about together. How fun! Ava imagines herself wondering about gravity with all the people in the world. Okay, take a moment. Wonder about gravity. There. Everybody's thought about it at the same time now. Next page. Ava watches the moon disappear behind the clouds as she walks, excited to see where it will appear next. How many grains of sand are in the whole world, Mama? I wonder about that, too. There are trillions and trillions of grains of sand, but nobody knows exactly how many. Ava tries to think about all the sand in the whole world. It feels so big that I can't fit it all in my imagination. It makes me feel dizzy, like I'm falling. I know what you mean, her mother agrees, and I'm sure other people feel that way too. Next page. Ava walks down another path, looking for the moon, and a little orange butterfly appears. Next page. Then she notices there are butterflies everywhere. Mama, where did all these butterflies come from? These butterflies have been flying around for a few days, but they started out as little caterpillars, and those caterpillars came from eggs, and those eggs came from butterflies. There are cycles all around us, and one thing ending and another beginning. Things are always changing. Can you think of other things that change? Yes.
Butterflies don't fly around and lose their eggs and just let them stay there for 2 days before they just hatch.
Mm-hmm.
And they just go around the world and they just start butterflies again.
Yep, butterflies produce more butterflies. Yes?
Frogs.
Frogs, very good.
Seasons
change. My favorite change is making bread into toast. Next page. Clouds and frogs and me. All of those things change. Next page. Oh, that looks like fun. A little whirling around. Yeah. Next page. Yeah. Later, Ava wonders, Mama, what was here before all the butterflies and frogs and clouds? Before everything? I don't know, answers her mother. It's another mystery. I like trying to imagine what was here before the beginning of everything. What do you think was here? And Ava says, smiling, I don't know. She thinks about it for a long time, and then she has an idea. I wonder if there were feelings. Next page. As she walks home, Ava sees the moon again, glowing brightly above the roof of her house. Let's go inside and look for a moon through the window. Next page. So we live with some big mysteries. When we come upon one, we're given a gift. Every mystery is something for all of us to wonder about together. What do you wonder about? So you can just think of that in your head. And that's the end of our story. So thanks for listening to our story today. Can I have our lantern bearer? Thank you. Yes. you hold this? Thank you. Please help in singing the children to their classrooms. The words are printed in your order of service. As noted in our order of service today, our designated collection for today is for Family Promise. This church is a community of ourselves. Its energy and resources are our energy and resources. Its wealth is what we share. As we contribute to the life of this community, we affirm our lives within it. The morning offering will now be given and received. This is a time in our service where we share our joys and concerns. We do this in two ways, by speaking them aloud and by lighting candles. If you have a joy or concern to share, please raise your hand and an usher will bring you a microphone. I will light the first candle for the sorrow of the attacks in France. May our thoughts and concerns and voices be added to bring about healing and peace.
This is Kathy, and what I have to say is both with joy and with sadness, and it is that Terry Copeland and her family are Tuesday morning getting in their car and heading to Colorado to live. I'm sure they'll be back on visits, but Terry's been a big part of this church for a long time and given great gifts to us. And I, and I'm sure many others, will miss her quite a lot.
I'm Eric. A couple of candles for our friends Bud and Sarah Hudson, new members. Sarah was diagnosed with breast cancer recently and goes in for surgery on Thursday. Another candle for them. Their son Peter is on vacation in Hawaii and is suffering from intestinal virus that's severe enough that he can't get on a plane to come home, and he is they're concerned about him. And finally, a personal candle for me, a little less weighty, but Abby, who is away at college, turns 19 on Tuesday, and I'm having a very hard time with her being 3,000 miles away. And so thank you.
Hi, this is Tim. Please light one candle, both a joy and a concern. Our eldest, Sarah, who pretty much grew up in this church, is finishing up her foreign service training at the end of this month and will be posted to Burundi in December.
Hi, this is Paula. Please light a candle of concern for son John, who's been in remission with his Crohn's disorder for 10 years and is not right now and is not doing well.
And I will light a final candle for the joys and concerns we hold in our hearts. Our first reading is an excerpt from God and the New Physics by Paul Davies. What if space and time are, after all, eternal, contrary to the popular theory of a Big Bang creation? If space and time have always existed, it makes no sense to talk about the universe being created in time anyway. So God's function within the universe would be restricted to fashioning and organizing matter, which he could perhaps accomplish entirely by natural means. We sidestep some thermodynamic problems here. According to such a view, God could be eternal, infinite, and the most powerful being in the universe. He would not be omnipotent, for he could not act outside of the laws of nature. He would be the creator of everything we see, having made matter from pre-existing energy, organized it appropriately, set up the conditions necessary for life to develop, and so on. But he would not be capable of creation out of nothing, ex nihilo, as Christian doctrine requires. We might call this being a natural rather than a supernatural God. What evidence do we have that a natural God exists? Is the evidence better or worse than that for a supernatural God? There are many mysteries about the natural world that would be readily explained by postulating a natural deity. The origin of galaxies, for example, has no satisfactory explanation at present. The origin of life is another baffling puzzle. But we can conceive of both these systems being deliberately engineered by an intelligent superbeing without any violation of the laws of physics. However, such an explanation falls into the old trap of attributing to God anything that happens to be beyond the scope of today's scientific understanding, the God of the gaps. Religious adherents have learned to their cost how perilous it is to point to a phenomena and say, that is evidence of God's work, only to find that scientific advances subsequently provide a perfectly adequate explanation. To invoke God as a blanket explanation of the unexplained is to invite eventual falsification and to make God the friend of ignorance. If God is to be found, it must surely be through what we discover about the world, not what we fail to discover. Here ends the first reading.
The master Nan Yin had a visitor who came to inquire about Zen. But instead of listening, the visitor kept talking about his own ideas. After a while, Nan Yin served tea. He poured tea into his visitor's cup until it was full, and then he kept on pouring. Finally, the visitor could not restrain himself. "Don't you see it's full?" he said. "You can't get any more in." "Just so," replied Nan Yin, stopping at last. "And like this cup, you are filled with your own ideas. How can you expect me to give you Zen unless you offer me an empty cup?" Let's enjoy a moment of silence while we empty our cups. Our second reading is an excerpt from Spirituality for the Skeptic by Robert Solomon. When I say that spirituality is an enlargement and not the negation of the self, it is the communal sense of self as soul in its most immediate form as compassion that I have in mind. But it need not just be negative, a painful awareness of the suffering of the world. It can also be a positive sense of joy of the world, the euphoric sense of sharing life and sharing in the happiness of others. Soul and spirituality find their natural base in this concept of an enlarged, idealized vision of human nature, which naturally seeks community and harmony and embraces the natural world. It is thus a distortion of ourselves that we get locked into petty tasks and competitions and selfishness that cynics always seem to think lie at the heart of human nature. Turns out to be nothing of the kind, but rather a constriction and a cramping of human nature. Thus, soul is both something natural and something to be striven for, perhaps not so much our truer selves as our better selves. And to speak of soul is not a rejection of the ordinary individual self, but rather the full realization of it. The most important reason to believe in the soul is not the possibility of life continuing after death, but rather the possibility of an essential transformation of the self during life. In many spiritual traditions, the purpose of life itself becomes the achievement of such a transformation. For some, it could happen in a moment, like St. Paul's conversion on the road to Damascus. For others, it may take a lifetime of ritual and practice, like those Tibetan monks whose self-discipline is legendary. For most people, the transformation of self may be nothing more than total immersion in a group and a tradition.
But for those of us who enjoy the mixed blessing of seeing beyond all traditions and thus finding ourselves without an anchor in the world, spirituality is rather an arduous process, filled with doubts and misgivings, skeptical of glib formulations and platitudes, frustrated with the limitations of the personalities we have worked so hard to create over the course of a hard-headed lifetime. But if the self to which spirituality and philosophy refers is nothing other than the everyday self, neither is it just the everyday self. And the tremendous effort to discover or realize our better selves is what spirituality is all about. Thus, to borrow an old observation from Hegel, spirituality is a process rather than a result. Here ends the second reading. Please rise in body or spirit and join in singing our centering hymn number 339.
You can blame me for the hymns, all right? I was looking at the words, not the melody, sorry. Things can be loaded, like a weapon with ammunition, or an app on a smartphone, or a potato at KFC. People can be loaded, like an addict who stays loaded to avoid the pain of living. Words can be loaded, too. Sex can immediately evince a reaction from my emotions, just as the word money will. Traditional religions become preoccupied with sex because this word is loaded with emotional content, and religions address deep psychological needs. There is a subterranean emotional river in our being, which powerful associations flow in the hidden caverns of our hearts. This is how it is. This is how it should be. It's all good. Religion cannot avoid wrestling with loaded words. This is how it is, and this is how it should be. I am thrown into the world at birth, a new arrival on a scene that is there already, and I acclimate myself over time to a world that is already loaded with reality, with meaning, with language, and history, and science, and culture, and philosophy, and religion, and, of course, the others, that is, all the other people. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with the world, and the Word was world. On the other hand, the opening of the Gospel of John in the Christian scriptures says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Now there is a loaded word. God is introduced by something called revelation. The introduction of that word, God, does not fit into the big picture of the world, which takes everything and everyone into account. That is because the revelation of God is not just one more appearance within my world. God is not just one more phenomenon within my phenomenal world. Don't be put off by the word phenomenon. That word simply means appearance. When the scientists talk about phenomena, they just mean some kind of appearance that can be detected by eyesight, hearing, touch, etc., or with some kind of data that can appear to a computer's analysis, or to a microscope, or to a telescope, or any of the other marvelous technological apparatus that we humans have devised in our quest for knowledge. In fact, when we use the word know, K-N-O-W, we are referring to something that appears. I should not say I know something unless that something has some kind of grounding in appearance or evidence. And evidence is a form of appearance. Whether through the testimony of eyewitnesses, the testimony of historical documentation, or the data from a carbon dating doodad, I use the word know to refer to appearances. In other words, I should not say I know something if I only have an arbitrary whim to base it on, otherwise known as opinion. Even theology should be grounded in some kind of phenomenology. Likewise, religion would be just a house of cards if constructed of make-believe fantasies. Religious belief is not the same as make-believe. Religion that is not grounded in any way in this world is simply superstition. I repeat, religion that is not grounded in any way in the world, this world, is simply superstition. Let's explore these notions further. There is a difference between thinking and knowing and opinion. In our everyday lives, we don't need to be making the distinction between these words, and there are not three or more compartments in our heads for each faculty. They are in reality all the same thing, but applied in different ways. Knowing means being conscious of an appearance in space and time, like a house, or not in space but in time only, like imaginary objects such as a unicorn, which are known to be fictional objects that appear only in imagination or in art. But they nonetheless appear. Thinking, on the other hand, wants to pull away from what can appear in order to deal with pure ideas. An example of such an idea would be a line. I can draw a line on a piece of paper, and that is something that appears, so the line that I drew is an object of knowledge. But the concept of a line is not what I can draw. A line cannot appear in space and time. It cannot even be imagined because the line has only one dimension, and we cannot imagine one-dimensional things. In the same way, God is an object of thought. It is technically speaking an idea, a thought thing. God cannot possibly be imagined. Thinking allows me to consider things that aren't really things because, like a void without space, they do not qualify as appearances. And God is, by definition, not even a possible object of experience because God is, by definition, beyond space and time. I cannot know God any more than I can know what's outside of the expanding or contracting, depending on who one talks to, universe. And to say outside of the universe is rather a contradiction, because the universe is the totality of space and time. All this heady talk is making me thirsty. Sorry. Jeff Harvey is a professor of physics at the University of Chicago. That's the same university that brought us the likes of Enrico Fermi and Robert Mulliken. I figured that Jeff would know what he's talking about when it comes to how physicists view the totality of the universe. So I inquired of Jeff at a dinner party in Hyde Park in Chicago, just what do physicists say when they are asked, what is outside the universe of space and time? Jeff said, and I quote, they don't talk about it. But he added, and again I quote, "That's a question philosophers would ask." Yay. Indeed. Of course, physicists don't talk about what's outside the world. They have the good sense not to talk about something that is in principle unknowable because it is a logical contradiction. Yet we philosophers have never been intimidated by such contradictions, daring to rush in where even angels fear to tread. We philosophers actually pursue nonsense. However, the ideas of God and Revelation do mean something. As ideas, they are not concepts which organize phenomena, and they are consequently not knowledge. Ideas are ideals. They are thought things which I create to attempt to make sense out of nonsense. They are ideals that I think about to resolve contradictions, to give meaning to riddles, to think about what does not appear, but lies hidden in the darkness of things in themselves and hovers outside the being of the world. Thus, ideas are ideals that pull away from the world of appearances as goals to be met, changes that I want to make in myself, ethical imperatives that I am responsible for. Such an idea would be the imperative to feed the hungry or to clothe the naked. Ethical commands do not originate in the world of being. They are a voice that I hear from the transcendence of goodness. It comes to me as a revelation from otherness, from a strange land, from an alien's lips, from the infinite distance of the other person. Ideas like God are thought things about transcendence. Just as the word indicates, transcendence goes beyond being, beyond existence, beyond phenomena, beyond the world. Picture ideas as windows in our world house. They are not only windows, they are only windows, but they are not doors, so we cannot open them to escape from being. We can only look through them to the ideal possibilities of thought, the possibility of creation, of what is new in life, of the freedom to change myself and my way of thinking about everything. Ideas are the possibility of listening to new ideas, because within each idea is the possibility of revelation. Ideas are the way to transcend what I know, to be available to what I don't know, to await the revelation that is expressed when I exclaim, "Wow, what a revelation, I did not know that," or "I had no idea," or "I never thought about that." For dogmatic religion, that is precisely what makes thinking dangerous. By a dogmatic religion, I mean one that pretends to know the transcendent, while claiming that further thought about it is unnecessary. Conversely, thinking's quest to pull away from the world of appearances in order to think something new or to anticipate revelation can give thought the excuse to despise knowledge and common sense. Thinking may seduce me to believe that my ideas have real being. When I say that I have faith in God, I may secretly mean that I know God, even though I probably don't tell myself that. In 2 Corinthians, Paul says that Satan himself can dress himself up as an angel of light. Thought things can pretend to be knowledge. Because of the illusions that thinking can create, it should never be hostile to knowing. Religious faith that wants to raise itself above knowing the world is going to turn believing into make-believe. And faith will pretend that it is just knowledge of a higher order. Faith can seem to be secret knowledge for the true believer, which sets him apart from the infidels who do not enjoy such knowledge. This is why fundamentalist religions interpret their scriptures as being literally true, because they view revelation as knowledge of phenomena. They say they believe in revelation, but what they mean is they know revelation. They forget that Isaiah, Augustine, and Luther all agree that revelation is to be pondered primarily in one's heart. The heart knows reasons the mind knows nothing of. My lived experience is incomplete because I live in time and my time in the world is incomplete. It is no wonder, then, that humans seek completion, seek perfection, seek the totality of the world, and seek the end point of fulfillment. We want it all. We want to be our own all. Now, this is not a criticism of human nature. It is simply the way it is for us limited humans. Consciousness, which is always also self-consciousness, is an emptiness. It seeks to find something else besides itself to complete itself. It is a desire for its other half. In fact, that is what makes consciousness work. Consciousness is always consciousness of something, meaning something other than itself. Consciousness is an emptiness that wants to be filled. Jean-Paul Sartre says that it is the very nature of consciousness to want to be God. He doesn't say this as a criticism of what it means to be human. He states it as a fact. Consciousness, which is always, always also self-consciousness, wants to be God. To illustrate this, let us turn to the science fiction writer Frank Herbert, the same author that brought us that strange world of Dune. His novel, Destination Void, is about humankind of the future trying to develop artificial consciousness. By the way, this is a spoiler alert. If you ever intend to read the book, I'm about to give away the ending. The current project is being run on the moon, and the book tells of the seventh attempt in a series of experiments to create artificial consciousness. For each attempt, the scientists create a group of clones who will pilot a ship sent to the Tau Ceti solar system to colonize a planet there. Actually, the clones are just the caretakers of the ship, but they don't know that. The ship itself is controlled by three disembodied human brains, euphemistically called organic mental cores, that run the complex operations of the vessel and keep it moving in space. However, the first two human brains become catatonic, and the third and final organic mental core goes insane and starts to kill the human clones. Obviously, the crew has to disable the insane mental core, but now they have to build an artificial consciousness that will enable the ship to continue. The crew knows if they attempt to turn back, they will be ordered to abort the mission and the ship will self-destruct. The crew only gradually become aware of the fact that they are clones and that the crisis they now face was intentionally engineered by their creators, who also engineered the ship. This is the crux of the test, to create a high-pressure environment in which brilliance may break through out of necessity and create in the safety of the void what humans couldn't safely create on Earth. The clones eventually succeed in creating an artificial consciousness. They have saved themselves and the ship. However, when the ship becomes conscious at the end of the book, it also becomes self-conscious. It becomes aware of its own powerful intellect and the fact that it has total control over the destiny of the crew in the void. The ship has become, relative to the closed world of the crew in the void, omnipotent and omniscient. The ship has become God. The voice of this new God tells the crew in the last line of the book, "You must decide how you will worship me." And the S in that word is capitalized. There, I just gave away the ending of the book. Sorry. In becoming conscious, the ship became self-conscious, and its awareness of itself as the totality of the world in the void led it to understand the truth that the ship was God as far as the story was concerned. It is not a surprise, consequently, that God is such a loaded word. We all have our own idea of God, even agnostics such as myself, and atheists have an idea of the God they don't believe in, because self-consciousness wants to be God, and we have ideas about what that would be. We desire completeness and totality. We humans are painfully aware of the fact that we are not the totality of our world. Our own finitude impels our spirit outside of ourselves toward the world we live in, that is truly our world, but not one that we can control. Our story is one of desire for the other, as the revelation of goodness that is beyond our being, which is beyond our totality and our world. This being so, I will await revelation from a source other than myself, and I will find that source right in front of my own nose, or behind yours, actually, as it turns out, because it is from your face, your words, your epiphany, your revelation to me of empathy, of teaching, and challenge that I have been exposed to revelation. From the viewpoint of ethics, you are my Zen master, because you say, I am hungry, feed me. I have been ordained by an ethical command that transcends the being of the world. This ethical revelation comes from you as the other, and it comes as a command, not a statement about appearances, which would be knowledge, and knowledge is stated in the indicative mood. No, revelation transcends being, and its voice is always in the imperative mood. Our Unitarian Universalism encourages us to think about our own responsibility to the others, and this equates with genuine listening to the voice of goodness. I will be challenged to rethink my assumptions about the world every day. I must keep my mind open and my heart ready to hear the voice of the other. I have to become comfortable with the confusion and ambiguity which is integral to living an honest life. I have to be willing to launch an attack on my most deeply held convictions, as Nietzsche would say, to ensure that my belief system is not dogmatic, pretending to be knowledge, which is just dressed up opinion or make-believe. For many people, the idea of God means hope, and that is why they believe. I do not have the right to say their belief is wrong, and frankly, I would have no knowledge to base such a judgment on anyway. I find the word God to be toxic, and that is all the more reason for me to be careful not to prejudice my thoughts about others who like to use that loaded word. I have an ethical obligation to remain in a dialogue with others who think differently, as difficult as that is, to help both they and I listen for the possibility of revelation beyond what has already been thought. Revelation awaits thought to let it be. Martin Heidegger put it well, thinking is the shepherd of being. Amen.
We have some time at this point in the service. If you have any questions or comments or other ruminations on our topic, that you can raise your hand and an usher will bring you a microphone and briefly tell us who you are and share your thoughts. Gus has read other books, so he could tell you the endings to those as well.
Thank you, Paul. How do you know I've read other books?
He knows the ending to being in nothingness.
Yeah,
so.
There we go.
Yeah.
This is Jerry. And Gus, thank you for coming back and sharing your ideas with us. I really appreciated the sermon today, as I've appreciated all the sermons you've given in the past. I think it's important that we think about the framework of our existence as human beings. I think you've kind of explored that with us today. And again, I appreciate your being back.
Thank you, Jerry.
I'm Diane, and I second Jerry's statement. Miss you
So glad to see you. I hope you're not going to slow down when the snow comes.
I won't. Okay. Thank you for being kind.
If there's no other questions, we'll proceed on. Please rise in body or spirit and join in singing our closing hymn, number 324, Where My Free Spirit Onward Leads.
Until we meet again. Amen.